KPFA.org/bluecampaign. Your second look could be their second chance. KPFT Houston.
KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You see, we're getting synchronized.
We got it this time.
And this is a pre-recorded show, so unfortunately you still can't call in, and unfortunately this is probably what we're going to have to do for a while because of the COVID-19 virus isolating, quarantining, self-social distancing thing. But we do have an interesting show. We always try to have an interesting show, and hope you will find it entertaining and thought-provoking.
Yeah.
We're currently recording this in the early morning hours of Monday, April 13th. I'll have to change that in my notes. Just for the record, the Houston Harris County Clerk's Office is available online if you need to do clerk business. Mm-hmm. Simplest way to do that is to go to harrisvotes.com, where you can also find out about various election delays and ballots and whatnot. From harrisvotes.com, there is a link you can take to the county clerk's office, which is a little more complicated than the harrisvotes.com. Other cities and other counties have also changed their election information, so I would recommend going to your appropriate county clerk in order to find your current election status. For those who are curious, the IRS, well, let's start with this. Sort of in the Trumpist regime, there was word made that July 15th was the new tax deadline. Mm. In fact, Forbes.com has run an article. You can see it when I post the show links. The IRS announces new July 15th tax deadline for expats, trusts, estates, and corporations, and includes a June 15th estimated payment submission. That's for those who do like monthly or quarterly submissions. So there is a notice, and again, link. It's called Notice 2020-23, confirms that all individuals, trusts, estates, corporations, and other non-corporate tax filers, including Americans living abroad, get until July 15th to file and pay their federal income taxes. So if you're like me, I'm going to try to get somewhere around the April 15th deadline just because I don't want to like stretch this out.
Yeah.
But if your life is creating challenges for you, you do have until July 15th to postmark and pay any federal taxes due. You don't have to meet the April 15th deadline. My suggestion is just try to. No point in adding this stress to your life.
I want to quickly ask. So this excerpt from the Forbes article says, quote, all individuals, trusts, estates, corporations, and other non-corporate tax filers. That seems like a contradictory statement to me, because surely corporations are a corporate tax filer.
No, they're talking about things like LLCs, LLPs, those sorts of things. There are various kinds of business and non-profit entities and whatnot.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Well, I guess that shows what I know about taxes.
That's why I'm here.
Yes.
One of the things that I never started my clock. Oh, that's annoying.
Great.
Yeah. Do you have a clock?
Well, yeah, I've got the recording time, and it's 5 minutes behind. So we've been going for 4 minutes and 5 seconds.
Okay. So. I can deal with that. So one of the things, you know, we've been talking a lot about forward-looking events, conditions, circumstances, changes. That's what we've done really for the last three shows, and I think that's why a pre-recorded show can still be relevant. We've talked a lot about how current circumstances may be indicating directions in which we will go. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about this pandemic as a generation-defining event. The flu, 1918 flu, was a defining event for that generation. The Great Depression in the 1930s was a defining event for that generation. It changed people and how they behave.
Mm.
And what we're kind of experiencing, we're experiencing the equivalent in a modern sense of a 1918 flu, which increasingly is looking like it could lead also to a Great Depression. So will our generation defining event, and of course I'm old, so, you know, I've got at best 10 or 20 years left, at best. But we're talking about a generation of defining event for people, say, under 50, particularly under 30, that will impact how they see the world, how they evaluate their life, what their expectations of life are, how they'll treat hygiene and finances and job security. I mean, there's no telling exactly what the consequences will be. All we can be sure of is that there will be consequences, and they will be multi-generational.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is definitely going to be an important event in history. It already is. I don't know if it's going to be the defining event of the generation, though.
God, because, let's hope there's nothing worse.
I mean, let's hope there's nothing worse. But, I mean, a generation-defining event doesn't necessarily have to be a bad one. It could be a good one. We could make the first advances into real space travel. We could meet aliens, or we could make the first strides toward fusion power. Or, you know, there's a number of other big things, that other big dreams that humanity has, that honestly we just never know when they'll come true or when they'll be start to be realized. And but even if it is other negative events, I have to wonder if this idea of a singular event defining a generation is maybe not quite accurate anymore, because I kind of would like to draw a comparison to weather events, 100-year floods, 1,000-year floods, and they're happening now a lot more recently. We've seen this with, and this is a symptom of climate change, but we've seen this with natural disasters like hurricanes. The flooding is so much worse than...
Well, I mean, I hate to interrupt, but I think we're kind of getting off the point.
You're right,
talking
okay,
about circumstances that are highly local, like tornadoes, or that are regional, like hurricanes, and that there are going to be people who will be traumatized by those events, and those traumas will be carried with them for some fraction, if not their entire lives.
Right.
What I'm talking about, when I call it a generation-defining event,
mm-hmm.
you know, the first show we did that sort of touched on this was, I was comparing this to the historical after effects of the great plagues of the 14th century.
Yes.
Where that provoked enormous social and technological change, aside from the mass death.
Yeah.
But that's what it provoked.
Well,
along with that, I'm sure it was plenty of trauma. You know, the song Ring Around the Rosie is about the plague. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that.
So that's a little children's ditty that has literally survived 700 years.
Yeah. But I think
that's impactful.
I think maybe I got too caught up in trying to provide context for my point. My point is that these kinds of events that we thought were rare are happening more and more frequently, and it's making us reevaluate our frame of reference for how rare an event is. And I have to wonder if, instead of having one generation defining event, if we will, as time goes on, I don't know whether humanity's event scale is accelerating or something like that. I don't know. But I have to wonder if historians will start to look back and say, there's not one generation defining event. There are a number of events that define a generation.
Or if
maybe that's just a different approach to looking at
history. I'm talking about a generation defining event from a trauma standpoint.
Okay.
And the responses of a generation of people who will have lived through the trauma of long-term social distancing, long-term self-isolation, many, many deaths among friends and family before this is over, probably changes in business practices, hiring practices, available jobs. My suspicion, significant increases in automation so that companies don't get caught by this kind of thing again where they don't have people to do jobs. The machines will do them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there are going to be many, many changes that will result both from personal traumas experienced by people around the world from this experience and perhaps the economic catastrophe to come, perhaps, as well as the butterfly effects of adaptive or perhaps maladaptive responses by individuals, corporations, governments, institutions, because there will be. I mean, what we're doing right now, pre-recording this show, and hopefully the quality little by little gets better, is an effect, and possibly a long-term one, of how we conduct business doing radio.
Yeah.
And maybe at some point we'll still be able to do this at home, and the sound quality will still be better, and maybe we'll also have people who can, quote-unquote, call in, not sure exactly what the process will be, but basically having other people participate in the show as we get more familiar with technology, as technology refines for us to find ways to do that. And the station does.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that's the case, we may never have to come into the station again. And the show may get better and better, and the capabilities of executing the show may get better and better. We don't know.
Mm. Well, I tell you what, if we never have to come into the station again, that may solve some of Pacifica's money problems.
It could well. Do you know, I didn't include the article in the show script, but there have been now studies of air quality and skies. And do you know that because people are commuting less, this is not necessarily a good thing in the overall, but because it's happening, because people are working less, commuting less, traveling less, urban skies and skies generally have never been so clear.
Well, I can
so definitely... if you have a telescope or if you just want to go naked eye, apparently you can see more stars now than at any other time in modern history.
I can definitely believe that the skies are clearer, the environment is overall having to contend with less pollution. And of course, I can't pull out a source for this, but I am fairly certain that I have seen at least one source, hopefully multiple sources, that have concluded that the impact of commuting and the average residential life, even on like a mass scale of, you know, the comparing really just the entire impact of residential living in the United States on the environment versus the impact of business and industry in the United States on the environment. There's
well, I'm
no
talking
context.
Even on a global basis. I'm not just talking the United States. Around
I know.
The entire world, Beijing, Singapore, in Australia, in cities in India, in Europe, in North America, even in South America. I mean, this is a global phenomenon. Even there was one guy who commented he likes to take astrophotos.
Right.
And he commented for the story that he's never been able to take astrophotos so readily without airplanes crossing through the photo.
Well, I would.
There aren't any airplanes. Is that a good thing? No, but it's a reality right now.
I know that your point is on a global scale, but I really only feel qualified to comment on a scale of the U.S. But I am fairly certain that the reason that the skies are so much clearer is not necessarily because people are commuting less. It's because the factories aren't running. Or they're not running as often. They're not putting as much pollutants into the atmosphere.
Well, it's a mixture.
Power plants have to work less because offices are closed, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, it's all of a piece. Cars are, per capita, probably more polluting than most factories because a factory, by definition, becomes a more efficient polluter. So puts out, even though it's putting out more pollution than, say, the people that work for it, the people that work for it are putting out proportionately more pollution.
You mean that one factory is less polluting than all of the cars in a given area?
Well, let's say one factory is less polluting than all of the cars that end up in its parking lot.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably, well, I'm
guessing at that.
I mean, that's
kind of the sense of what this article is saying, that between the reduction in industrial production and the reduction in driving, even recreational driving, buses, airplanes, trains, cars, motorcycles, all of that individually and cumulatively is having a visible atmospheric impact.
I can definitely believe that it would be contributing. I maintain my position, though, that I think that the main contributing factor to that is the reduced activity from business and industry. But I will totally agree that commuting and travel. I tried to invent a word there, and even I knew it wouldn't work. Commuting and travel would definitely play a role, no matter what the main cause was, because so many things play a role in our environment and our atmosphere.
All right, that brings up a totally irrelevant story. For people who watch The Walking Dead, there is a young girl who plays Judith, and because she's an amazing actress for her age, but when she's like in downtime, she finds things to do for recreation plus her schooling and whatnot.
Okay.
And she designed something for the character Daryl, or about the character Daryl, who's played by Norman Reedus.
Right.
And she drew a picture of a unicorn with the head of Norman Reedus. And in the little bit of interview that she gave, she decided to name it a Normicorn. And in the after show, Talking Dead, they have, of course, they had great fun with it during the episode, but occasionally they are still referring back to the Normicorn.
Great. That's
so, you know, coining words is what people do.
Yeah, that's true. Even when they don't intend to, like me.
Even when they don't intend to. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Yes. Hi there, folks.
Okay. Just making sure.
Sure.
We are doing a pre-recorded show, so unfortunately you can't call in. We hope at some point we will be introducing a capability to call in, or we'll go back to the studio. One or the other will happen first. Just so you know, if you want to keep up with what's going on at KPFT, listen to kpft.org. You can listen to live shows over the internet. You can find out what's going on at the station. If shows, we might be able to tell you whether shows are reruns or not. I mean, there is information there that can be had. And perhaps most importantly, there is a donation link, which the station may need now more than ever. If you're in a position to help, go to kpft.org, click on the donate link, hopefully choose Think Wing Radio as the program you're supporting, and contribute whatever you can, large or small. You can also text to 713-5... Now, this is a text. Don't call. You can text to 713-526-5738. Text the word GIVE, and it will take you through a process where you can, again, choose the show you want to support, how much you want to donate, whether you want to make it a one-time or continuing. And it's very simple. You don't have to call anything or, you know, or even go on the internet. You can just do it from wherever you are on your phone.
Yeah.
My website, where you can find recordings of the shows that we do and links to the things that I refer to, I always have articles that I'm drawing information from, except occasionally when we go on to things that are just kind of sides where I don't necessarily have an article. But there's tons of links on my show sites. And that's at thinkwingradio.com, thinkwingradio.com. Thinkwing Radio is one word. You can also follow me on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio and on Facebook, Thinkwing Radio. You see, it's a theme.
Mm.
It's a theme.
And
okay, so go ahead.
And you can follow me on Twitter at, it's spelled Dominate EYE. It is pronounced Dominate I. But I use Tumblr a lot more often. My Tumblr blog is Dominate I. That is spelled Dominate EYE dot Tumblr.com.
T-U-M-B-L-O-R. So there are two E's in the middle there is the important bit of that.
Yes, there are two E's in the middle there. So those are my social links, which I'm going to start giving out because, I don't know, we could all use a little bit more social interaction virtually in this time.
Not that I'm one to talk, might consider a less complicated, maybe Dominant I would be simpler, but that's up to you. That's your thing.
It's been around too long. I would change it if I could probably, but I like it too much and I'm too used to it. So
yeah, that's like my email. I've had the same email since 1996 and I pay $50 a year just so I have, you know, whatever. Just because changing email addresses is just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You were hanging with me when we had to reboot my computer and you remember what a project that was, and that pales beside a change of email address.
Yeah.
Okay, next thing. This is from CNN Business from April 8th. Headline says, wanted urgently, people who know a half-century-old computer language so states can process unemployment claims. And it starts off that in New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy put out a call for volunteers who know how to code in a decades-old programming language called COBOL, C-O-B-O-L, which stands for Common Business Oriented Language. It used to be very popular, and you know this kind of gets into, and by the way, just in the rest of the article, they talk about how much demand. It says literally we have systems that are 40 plus years old, Murphy says. There'll be lots of postmortems on one of them on our list. How did we get here where we literally need COBOL programmers?
Mm.
The language was developed in 1959. I'm not even a programmer, and I know that there have been any number of more capable, more versatile computer programming languages, but COBOL apparently still a thing.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, as someone who comes out of retail and some business situations, retailers, and I'm not going to name any, but retailers often have point of sales that on one level either interact with or are in some way related to something like Windows 2000 or Linux or something like that. But what you find, if you have a business that's been around for a long time, they started computerizing in DOS, MS-DOS, which stands for Microsoft Disk Operating System, if you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparently really, really hard, if not impossible, to convert this DOS-based database into a modern database. So what you will find in most of these companies, no matter how up-to-date their interfaces look, it's all wrapped around their old DOS databases.
Yeah.
And at some point, you basically get into what amounts to a green screen
mm-hmm.
in order to work in DOS.
Mm.
So this kind of a situation is not necessarily unheard of, but it does indicate how problematic it is. that businesses have a tax incentive to upgrade. This is one of the differences between businesses and government that I like to point out. Business and government are not the same. You can't run them the same way. Their priorities are different. Businesses have a tax incentive because they depreciate stuff. And after a certain point, they can't depreciate it anymore. So they rather buy it so they can write it off again.
Mm-hmm.
Governments don't have that incentive. So you end up with really old equipment. There is data that NASA has accumulated since the 1960s that there are computers that can no longer read. The data is there. They have the data, you know, collecting metaphorical or real dust, sometimes being degraded by the environment.
Yep.
And they can't transfer it. They don't have the means to transfer it because the machines to read it no longer exist. Now, there has been a process of trying to recover and convert this data. But it's slow because the ability to do it is really limited. So what this is uncovering is a serious data processing vulnerability in states and municipalities and the federal government. And again, it kind of comes back to you get the government you pay for. If it's always about saving the last buck and doing more with less, this is the situation you end up in. And now the question is, will it cost more now to try to update this stuff than it would have cost to do it incrementally when there were transfer protocols included in a lot of software? Or will they decide to let it ride and maybe just start teaching COBOL more often? I mean, there are a lot of implications here. It's interesting when you read an article to think beyond the words of the article and start thinking of the broader implications of that article.
Yeah.
Andrew, do you have any thoughts?
I do. I mean, I will tell you.
I know you do.
Yes. So this article was very interesting to me, not necessarily because of what's actually this specific situation, but of a situation that it reminded me of, which I learned about through an excellent YouTube video by the YouTuber Lazy Game Reviews, LGR, in his Tech Tales series, when he talked about when the IRS's online filing system crashed on tax day either last year or the year before. And so basically he goes through the whole history of the IRS's tax filing system. I forget what year it started, but they got a around the first time that this sort of mainframe system was available from IBM, they got an IBM system in that became known as the Martinsburg Monster because it was housed in the National Computing Center at Martinsburg. And it's a really – I'm not going to say it's a really interesting story because it's not.
Yeah.
Not if you don't like – you know,
you have to be techie.
You have to be techie. But it is a very good example of what's going on here, this, because this is a very similar situation where – old systems that were just working for so long that nobody really had any reason to change or update were just kept around, and they accumulated more and more data, and the system became more and more reliant on them, and the changes that were made in order to keep these old, you know, grandfathered bits of the system working. Yeah,
essentially wraparounds and poured into and that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Or bodges, as some people are fond of calling them.
What's the word?
Bodge. B-O-D-G-E. It's like I forget the other word. But anyway, you put something together quickly to try and make sure that everything stays up. And it's a good reminder that you need to be constantly thinking about what updates and changes you can make before it becomes too late, before it becomes more trouble or more money than it seems to be worth to make big updates to your systems. And then eventually the cost that you pay of not having kept them updated is that they go down or they bottleneck, as in the case of, the state systems. And it's just, that's why I was so interested in this article, even though I don't really know the specifics behind this situation, is just because this is the only reason, really, that I know anything about what COBOL is because of this story.
Well, and here's sort of another interesting way to think about this.
Mm.
these machines running this old language are not new machines.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they're big. They generate a lot of heat.
Yep.
People my age remember going into a computer room where it was kept at 60 degrees to keep the computers cool. Mm. Now, envision this. They must have actual computer rooms to house these machines. They're pretty much as big as cars.
Yeah.
And there's the question of parts.
Mm-hmm.
There's the question of power consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Square footage has cost.
Mm-hmm.
Maintenance of such specialized equipment has cost. I will tell you that my brother-in-law from the 1960s or 70s, he's a little older than me, I think. Not my brother-in-law, my stepbrother. He wrote a debugging program. I don't know if it was for COBOL, but I'm having a sneaking suspicion. He wrote a debugging program for an IBM mainframe that at that time was very dominant in business.
Right.
And perhaps government as well. And he made a business out of providing this debugging service using his proprietary program. And he would go around the country. And he's told me the story that he thought that that business would last maybe 3-5 years.
Yeah.
And it lasted until he retired a couple of years ago.
Wow.
Because these machines were still in service.
Yeah.
So this is like a side effect of this specialized application that is still running these 50-year-old machines.
Yeah.
This is going to be very interesting on many levels, not the least of which is when the crisis passes, will they still be running old machines that require computer rooms that are running COBOL?
Yeah.
We'll see.
And yeah, I mean, you know, modernization efforts are all like are underway, but it's such a complicated situation in so many of the agencies and departments of government that use these systems where you really can't just overhaul the whole system all at once because it's impractical in that it costs too much or it would take the system offline for too long.
Well, I think what you have to do and what is sometimes done in these situations is you develop the follow-on system in parallel.
Yeah.
So you don't stop running the old system until the new system
is ready
is indicating
over.
That it has the robustness, I think is the word, to now take over basically like a baton change in a relay race where there's no real downtime.
Yeah. And
but you know, they still haven't figured out how to port DOS into Windows into like Windows 10.
Mm.
So, yeah. Whoever comes up with that program who can figure out how to take that data and that old format and put it into some kind of a new database program and transfer it correctly, that person will make a fortune.
Yeah. Yeah. They sure will. They sure will.
So far, no one. So far. That hasn't been the answer. They've just ported around it. Okay. Going on to the next story, there was an article. See, who is it from?
Ooh.
This was from,
The New York Times, the link seems to be from.
Okay, I think my link is somehow messed up. So, yes, this is from the New York Times. I'll have to make sure I correct that before I post it.
Okay.
And the headline is, Black-owned businesses could face hurdles in federal aid program. Minority business owners have always struggled to secure bank loans. Now many want to deal only with existing customers, the banks, that is, when making loans through the government's $349 billion aid package. And then it goes on to tell several individual stories. Obviously, I couldn't put all of them in my show post, but the link will be there. The essence of it, as I recall having sort of digested it in my mind, is it sort of goes back to a history of redlining where banks and other lenders would have neighborhoods or actual individuals based on race, ethnicity, religion, whatever, that would be treated differently for the purposes of credit or lending. Mm-hmm. Some might be more favored. Some might be more discriminated against. Some neighborhoods couldn't get home improvement loans or mortgages at all. And there are laws against that from the 1960s and 70s. But like many things, there are sometimes workarounds where you can discriminate without making the discrimination legally obvious.
Yeah.
And you have a number of small business owners in this article, minority small business owners, people of color, who have been trying now to see if they can take advantage, and I don't want to use that phrase, if they have the ability to apply for these funds that are available to generally any small business in order to try to survive this period.
Right.
And they're finding, for example, there's one story about a young woman who owns a salon. She went to a Bank of America branch where she has a checking account, but couldn't get a credit card there. So at a future point, she went to Capital One and was able to get a credit card there. Now, going through this crisis, she goes to what she considers her primary bank, Bank of America, where she has her business checking. And they're saying, no, no, because you have a Capital One credit card, Capital One is your primary bank. So now she's caught in this no man's land, so to speak, of credit application.
Yeah, importantly, Capital One at this point wasn't accepting those emergency relief loan applications.
Right. Yes, that's another point that's made, is that Capital One wasn't accepting the emergency relief applications as of Friday, which would be last Friday, last week. A week after the program was started, Capital One's website still advised borrowers to keep checking back for updates. Thank you for reminding me of that. Now, this to me actually is two components that are, in a sense, two different problems. The one problem is credit discrimination and the legacy of credit discrimination. And I don't like believing that's true, but in my head, I know that's a reality. But the other problem, and I've encountered this with people, so I'm saying this from personal experience. I can't say how widespread it is. I know that there is a lack of banking opportunities for people that get into a certain socioeconomic class. They don't have enough for minimum deposits. They keep getting hit with maintenance fees. And, you know, just generally, there's a term underbanked. The term is the underbanked, the people that really can't work with banks. So they end up going to these short-term loan operations where they get fleeced and debt traps and whatnot. That is a problem. But I think that part of that problem also comes back to my observation that I have met people who seem culturally, and I'm not saying this in a discriminatory way, it's not necessarily race-based, but there are people that culturally, from their families, from their friends and neighbors, who don't seem to have either confidence in a bank or familiarity with how to use a bank or how to get credit or why credit matters or how to use it and control it and be responsible with it. And I have actually confronted personally two totally different scenarios. I had one family that I wanted to help with getting some banking access and credit access. And it got to the point where I think they basically felt I was just being obnoxious about it. I really wanted to help them. But it was like, you know, we don't need banks. We don't work with banks. We don't want to get involved with banks. I thought maybe her son could get a student bank account where they don't have fees and they treat you more liberally. No. I don't want to bring him to a bank. I don't want to be in a bank. I don't need it. So that was one reaction, and that was something that was very ingrained in her and her family and people, I suppose, that she knows that must reinforce that behavior. On the other hand, I knew a young woman, a woman of color, a minority ethnic group. She had no credit. She couldn't get credit because she had no credit, which is an interesting problem. When I moved to Houston, before they had a whole banking network online, it's like I had credit in New York. I had zero credit in Texas. I had to start over. So this was kind of the situation that she was in. Her family had done everything with cash. That had always been the way they did it. They didn't do loans. If they needed money, they borrowed from family. She didn't have bad credit. She just had no credit. And little by little, over a couple of years, I helped her build credit that enabled her to buy a washer and dryer, that enabled her to get a credit card, and eventually get a nicer place to live in. So to some extent, it is a dual-track problem. There's the discrimination side of it, but there is also the cultural side of either fearing banks and credit or not understanding banks and credit or just not wanting to be involved with banks and credit. And then when you finally need a bank and credit, this is where you end up.
Yeah.
So indicated it was your turn. But like this young woman, Yasmin Young, she had a small business. She had borrowed money from family to start the business, et cetera. But what she didn't have was someone to advise her along the way, and her bank, perhaps in good faith, to help her to actually build credit. So when she actually needed it, she had this problem. This is not a rare problem. This is unfortunately a very, very common problem, hence the term underbanking. So, Andrew, I'm sorry, your turn.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if it's a two-track problem. I think the two tracks are really, if not the same track, they're at least connected. I think a lot of people's – I obviously can't speak, you know, from experience personally. But I think that a lot of different racial groups who have been discriminated against through redlining, through more subtle, more modern discriminatory practices, have developed a distrust of banks or developed an aversion to them because they've been discriminated against, and that's. And when when trust has been broken between a person and an institution, it's very difficult to establish that trust again. And some would say that it's not necessarily worth establishing that trust. Sometimes it may just be worth limiting the role that that institution plays in the person's life, because there is a case to be made that there could be a systemic problem with that institution, in that it can't reliably and in good faith serve those communities because of the fact that it took actions that harmed these communities and broke that trust in the first place. And
I don't necessarily disagree with most, if not all, of what you're saying. But, you know, there's such a thing as a maladaptive response versus an adaptive response. And sometimes what was originally an adaptive response can over time become a maladaptive response. Whether there is discrimination in a particular bank branch or whether there is discrimination, subtle or otherwise, in a financial institution, at this point, the law supports someone going into a bank and trying to obtain credit. And sometimes it's a matter of finding the right bank.
Right.
Different banks have different policies. Different banks charge fees under a certain balance. Some charge more, some charge less. Most bank accounts and checking accounts have interest, but it's often 0.01% at many banks, but not all banks.
Let me just finish.
You can research now with the internet, because knowledge is not only power, it's survival. You can actually search banks. There are some banks that are online banks. There are some banks that are both online and brick and mortar. And what you're finding is that there is a mixture of banks that can serve the currently underbanked, assuming they have the technology to utilize them. Now, one of the things that has happened over the years is you have smartphones. And the smartphones have apps. And you can even deposit checks by phone. So this enables you to use a bank that may have very favorable terms that you never have to actually visit a physical location for. Right. You know, you can get a credit card from them. You can get a checkbook from them. You can have direct deposit of paychecks, or if people write checks to you, you can have them sent to the bank. You can get some interest, usually a good deal more than 0.01. Mm-hmm. There are many of these online banks don't have minimum balances for savings, don't have minimum balances for checking. Now, they might give you less interest, but they don't bill you with fees.
Right.
So it isn't just a matter of we need people to learn to trust banks and build their credit rating. It's a matter of these people finding, or these people getting help to find, the right kind of financial institution for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because these institutions do exist that can help some, if not most, of the underbanked develop some relationship with a bank.
And we may also need to try and regulate the existing banking industry to be more, open and receptive to these people who are underbanked, these people who are underserved, and to try and correct some of the not mistakes, because a lot of them were deliberate. Some of the unhelpful behavior, the discriminatory behavior that that these banks can engage in.
Well, the banks are looking for quote-unquote profitable customers.
Right.
And as you and I have discussed in a private conversation before the show, behavior is modeled. So it comes from the top, and the vice presidents model it, and then the assistant vice presidents, and then the regional managers, and then the district managers, and finally the branch managers, and then the branch managers train the employees, and they model the branch man. I mean, all of this ultimately is modeled. You can pass laws. We have passed laws. But enforcing the law down to the individual banker opening an account, that turns out to be much more challenging. And if it's not modeled from the top, you're still going to run into individual cases like this, even with the best intended laws.
It is definitely challenging, but there is plenty of legislation that still tries to take that approach because it's deemed to be the best approach, or at least the most politically viable approach for that particular
situation. But I will maintain, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're running a little short on time. I will maintain, and I think the bottom line here is, if you don't have credit, if you have bad credit, you don't necessarily have to pay to go to a credit advice agency. You can find friends. You can find associates. There are people. People want to help people. It's a natural impulse for most folks. If you seek the assistance, you will find it. If you seek the information on your smartphone, go on the internet. If you seek the information, I would say almost everybody can find some place where they can begin to bank and get credit and build history. It takes education. It takes information. In many cases, it may take assistance and guidance. Don't be too proud to take it. I'm not saying there aren't problems. I've railed against this kind of situation in banks for decades. One of the things that people have pitched out is, if you want to have a real fundamentally relevant role for the post office, something we might talk about later, make it a banking agency. Allow the underbanked to bank through the post office. Now, of course, the credit ripoff companies don't want that.
No.
But, from a social standpoint, from a socialistic standpoint, having a government agency as the banker of last resort, so that nobody has to be underbanked, that it's almost impossible to be underbanked except for some rare exceptions. There is a role for that. People should not be denied the opportunity to invest, to earn interest, to get credit, to be instructed on how to do this and how to do it responsibly, how to stay out of trouble with credit cards. I've had that problem. I understand it well. I've had a lot of weird stuff. Banking matters. It's part of this. Information is survival. So is credit. So is banking.
And if public banking is to be implemented in the U.S., it would definitely have to be watched very closely to make sure that it doesn't run into the same. It doesn't start to become discriminatory like other private banks have done in the past.
The devil is in the details, and who watches the watchers. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is a pre-recorded show on the morning of Monday, April 13th. I apologize that you can't call. Hopefully at some point we'll be able to take callers again. But we still try to offer interesting information, interesting discussion, relevant and hopefully timely stories. You can go to kpft.org. You can listen anywhere in the world online. You can also get information on the station, events, status reports. You can click on the donate link. You can help support the station if you have the ability in this difficult time. You can also go to my blog account, thinkwingradio.com, where I post audio copies of the shows, where I post the links and stories, and basically everything I'm looking at, I post for you to look at. So you can see whatever I'm basing my opinions and statements on. My co-host, of course, is Andrew Ferguson. We still have, what, about 10 minutes, Andrew?
We've got about 6.5 minutes left.
Okay, 6.5 minutes. So do you have anything else you want to share on the banking, or are we ready to move on to what will probably be our last topic?
I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. The Republican Party has been trying for – oh, wait a second. Okay, let me touch on this first, and then we'll go to the big story.
Okay.
Story from TheGuardian.com. Trump's poll numbers dip over handling of coronavirus pandemic, that apparently they'd gotten as high as 48%, and now they're 42%. Anyone who has listened to my show on a regular basis knows that I believe this is all just a distraction. If you look at all of the polls that have ever been conducted on Trump as quote-unquote president, if you look at the margin of error, which typically is somewhere between 2.5% and 3.5%, plus or minus, which is a 5 to 7% range, his poll support is pretty solid at somewhere between 42 and 43% when you take into account that margin of error. So watching numbers that are this close together, it's kind of pointless. If Andrew, if you want to make a comment, make it quick, and we'll go on to our last topic for the last several minutes.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who's diametrically politically opposed to Donald Trump, I'm not afraid to admit that. I am disappointed that his poll numbers are solid, but I guess, you know, there's a significant – I mean, the United States, when you compare it to the rest of the world, is a very conservative country, and so it's not really all that surprising. It's not great news, but, you know.
Well, next week I hope to have a guest, Stanley Sloan, and he has written a couple of books on the political climate in Europe and how it relates to transatlantic relations, so that should be an interesting show. Definitely. Give me a time check.
About 5.5 minutes.
Great. I think that'll be sufficient. So there's an article at CNN. U.S. Postal Service warns Congress it could become insolvent amid coronavirus. Now, the first thing I want to point out is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7 of the United States Constitution, which has come to be known as the Postal Clause or the Postal Power, empowers Congress, quote, to establish post offices and post roads. The Postal Clause then goes on, this is from Wikipedia, the Postal Clause was added to the Constitution to facilitate interstate communication as well as to create a source of revenue for the early United States. That's an opinion of that clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7. So they're talking about potentially a $25 to $54 billion shortfall that could make the post office insolvent.
Mm.
And my observation is this has been the goal of the Republican Party for decades. The Republicans have wanted to privatize the post office so that FedEx or UPS or whatever company would then be paid to do the mail. You know, socialism, bad. The thing is that the Postal Service, unlike private mail carriers, which UPS and FedEx are, is required to deliver goods to every corner of the country, including rural communities where profit margins are slim or, in many cases, negative. Without the Postal Service, Democrats warn some vulnerable populations won't be able to get prescriptions or essential goods, which have become crucial during the escalation of the corona crisis. So, I mean, my position is that the post office is essential. It's so essential that in the late 19th century, we had a Pony Express in order to keep the country connected.
Yeah.
I mean, there has been debate as to whether this postal clause actually mandates a government postal service or equivalent. And then there are some who speculate as to whether trying to put the postal service out of business and privatize it might be unconstitutional, and I suspect would be challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Andrew?
In our last couple of minutes here, we've got 2 minutes left about, I think that this sort of, I mean, obviously the Republicans have been trying to kill the USPS for a very long time, and I think it is kind of useful as a cautionary tale of what happens, well, of what happens when a government service is underfunded. You know, people complain about the USPS being slow and you know, the post office experience not being great and all that sort of thing. Well, you know, what else do you expect when you when a service is under attack, is being deliberately underfunded in order to try and sell it off? The same thing is happening in the UK with the NHS and the Conservative Party. It's not because the service is fundamentally flawed. It is because it is not being properly funded as part of a larger campaign to privatize it.
It's That's the libertarian philosophy of shrinking government to a point where it's small enough to drown in the bathtub.
Exactly. And that's what we have to fight against, not against establishing new services, because the government is there to help the people.
Okay. Are we basically at the end?
Basically, we've got a minute left about.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host and editor of this show has been Andrew Ferguson. Thank you, Andrew, for your technical assistance.
Oh, you're welcome.
Next week, we hope to have an interview program, which this format actually may lend itself to. We're going to talk about transatlantic relations, geopolitics, the effect of the coronavirus on geopolitics and transatlantic relations, and I think it could be a really, really interesting show. Stanley Sloan is a fascinating guy. I sort of accidentally developed a relationship with him. I'm really looking forward to that interview.
All right.
Andrew, anything?
Nope. Just okay. Make sure to wash your hands and stay inside.
Wash your hands with soap. Wear masks as much as you can, and stay inside as much as you can. Good points to remind us of. Okay, everybody have a great week. We hope this show is going to be broadcast on the 13th, but if it's not, it will still be on my website, thinkwingradio.com, on a show post for this date. And we'll be, Andrew and I will be looking forward to speaking with or at you folks again next week. Y'all take care.
Be safe. See you later, folks. Too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore. I know we'll be there by tomorrow.
Been in your car looking for news coverage or some new music. Maybe you were at home scanning the dial looking for something different. Your radio may have settled on KPFT and stayed there. If you're new to this station, here's how community radio works. We rely on listeners, not advertisers, for money. And it's not money for nothing. We use this money to operate our station. We hold membership drives a few times a year, and we ask for you to support our work with a pledge. If you give a call to 713-526-4000 and ask for the membership department, or go to kpft.org, you can pledge an amount of your choice to support KPFT. You've come to rely on us, but we would be in dire straits without you. This is